history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are people around you with stories that might put life and liberty in a little different perspective for you. If you take a little time to listen and consider what others have gone through for our sake, we want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom, and we sure do learn a lot. We are educated, we are entertained, we are so often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And this weekend, families all around America and all around the world will gather, so many of them getting together to celebrate Easter, which happens to fall on April 1st this year. Easter also fell on the first day of April in 1945, and today we're going to hear from three different World War II veterans about what they were doing on Easter Sunday 73 years ago. It might just make you even more thankful for the privilege and the freedom to enjoy the holiday weekend with your family this year. Let's start out with Bill Koning, who was a wide-eyed teenager from Grand Rapids, Michigan, when Easter Sunday 1945 brought him his very first taste of combat.
I was the so-called first scout in the 3rd Squad of the 2nd Platoon of I Company of the 341st Regiment and 86th Infantry Division.
Uh-huh.
And so as first scouts, you're supposed to see them before they see you.
Yeah, and that's one of the most precarious positions anyone could have in your whole division.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. First scout, yeah. You are the tip of the spear in that scenario.
But landing in Le Havre and cold, we went to a bar on the Rhine River, and the whole group was, they just walk into these places and you take over. And so this bar had a beautiful patio out looking over the Rhine. There was a normal infantry squad had maybe, was supposed to be 12, we had maybe 10, 9 guys. Look out and see Germans on the other side, very small things going past on bicycles once in a while. And so we were just sitting there. And along about the 1st of April was Easter, and they asked for volunteers to a patrol to go across the Rhine River and pick up a person, find somebody that knew what outfit was over there. Now, why they had to know the name of the German outfit, I don't know, but we were supposed to get a German prisoner and bring him back with us.
That sounds like a pretty mundane mission. No big deal.
No big deal. You know, it starts at the battalion, it comes bouncing, and finally it's our platoon. The platoon leader volunteered for it, and so then it's now who in the platoon is going to go. And so they ask for volunteers, and my squad leader, who I admired very much, volunteered, so I volunteered. Jim Karakoff from Norfolk volunteered. He was our BAR man, and our assistant squad leader volunteered. So that was 1, 2, 3 out of that squad. And there was another one out of the 1st squad, just a regular infantryman, and another one out of the 3rd platoon who volunteered. And so you got the leadership of the 2nd platoon pretty well taken care of, at least the 3rd squad taken care of. And so there were like 5 of us infantrymen and 3 engineers. And I can remember standing on they had a boat ramp going down to the Rhine River, and stand there and look around. There's just a dozen, about 10 of us. And you think about that. Maybe I'm not coming back. That's when it hit me.
That's the first time you thought that?
Yeah.
I can see why.
It's the first exposure, really, to anything. And so it's the 1st of April, and it's Easter Sunday. So they say, let's go. And so we run down the boat ramp, hop in the boat. Motor won't start. Quick, get the paddle. So we get the paddles out. We paddle across. Just before we get to the other side, a machine gun burst comes through the boat. I don't know how he missed as much as he did, but he did hit my squad leader. And I looked down, and here's Cowboy Letro. Cowboy is his nickname. Lying in the bottom of the boat, his face all blood. And so we get to the other side, and we hop out. We run up the bank, and there was a big church wall. Oh, maybe 30 feet high, big, big church wall. And just as we get ready to go into the town, which was a little path going into the town, another burst of that machine gun comes through and takes out the assistant squad leader. And so now we've lost 2 already. And I quickly jumped into a hole that eddy that the spring thaw had made in the bottom there. And Kirchhoff, the BAR man, jumped right on top of me. He landed on my back. He said, "Oh, just like the best hotel in town." And so we're stuck in this little hole in the ground. And I'm looking right up a boat ramp into the town. So I stick my head up to see what's going to happen. And I take a little ding on the top of my head, and the machine gunner's gone again. So I duck back down into the hole. And I pick up my gun, and I was using a friend's gun. It was a BAR, an automatic rifle. And I put it over the edge of the hole because I'm going to fight back. I pull the trigger, and it's supposed to go brrrr. It went pop. Dumb thing won't work. Mm-hmm. One shot at a time instead of automatic. So about this time, the lieutenant says, "This isn't going to work. We better go back." So we jump up and go back. And so now we left one man there, the assistant squad leader. He was killed. And the rest of us run back in the boat, paddle back across the Rhine River. And when we land, then the Germans now have got big artillery. And boy, they start shooting at that spot where we landed. That's the first cannon exposure we had. And boy, he was accurate as all get out. Now, I don't know how much damage he did to anybody else, but our group survived. But it was just a real touch and go in their artillery like you wouldn't believe. So we knew what war was all about.
I guess so. I didn't want to interrupt you in any of that, but I do have a few questions. You say your assistant squad leader was killed, and it was your squad leader who was hit before that in the boat?
That's right.
But he survived?
Yes, he survived. The bullet went in his mouth. I saw him after the war. Took out two teeth, went all the way down his neck, through his shoulder, and they took it out of his arm where you have your, what they call them, angel wings or something.
Yeah.
Took it out way down in his, halfway to his elbow.
Wow.
He survived, became a refrigeration repairman in Tennessee.
Wow. But you're exposed right here. This is your first real taste of combat, and yep. You're already seeing one guy you said you really admired almost killed, another guy in your squad killed, and you mentioned a ding on top of your helmet. Now, that wasn't someone with a little mallet playing with you.
He was shooting at me.
That was a machine gun bullet
Yes. That
hit your helmet.
Yes.
But fortunately, at the right angle that it didn't penetrate.
That far from the bottom of the helmet. So by 2 inches lower, he would have had me.
But it didn't even, it just bounced right off.
Bounced off.
Is that something that got your attention at the time, or is that one that night later on you're thinking, boy,
it got my attention. I kept my head down from then on.
Yeah, that's a little too close for comfort. So you guys had gone over to try to determine which German unit was there,
Yeah. Grab
a prisoner.
Yeah.
You realized, we're not going to get a prisoner. We got to get out of here or else we're going to be dead.
Yeah, the lieutenant realized that.
Uh-huh. And then when you got back to your side, their artillery was zeroed in on you. So what does that mean? There's shells going off right by you?
Yeah, they had us pretty well zeroed in. So you get down on the ground, you just sweat it out. A guy from another part of the platoon, when we landed, we knew they could see we had a wounded person aboard. And you're on the edge of a river now. And just up in the river, there was a cultivated field. And we hollered for the medic. And the guy that the Jeep driver in our company came bouncing across the field, and it's under heavy fire now. He volunteered and came bouncing across that field to get to Cali, pick him up. And fortunately, they gave him a Silver Star for it.
Well, they should.
Yeah.
He risked his life to save another.
Yeah.
But I'm still thinking about you being a 19-year-old kid. You're keeping your head down. You're ducking. But there's nothing you can do to stop that artillery from hitting you. If it lands on you, you're gone.
You're done.
So what are you doing with your head down? Are your eyes closed? Are you saying a prayer? Are you just gritting your teeth? What are you doing?
I don't recall any particular thoughts other than get as low as you can get. Get everything but your heels and your helmet. I don't have any thought now. Later on, we had more exposure to that sort of thing and mortar fire and all that. And got caught once in the middle of the street. And I said my squad leader got hit and the assistant squad leader got killed. They suddenly made me the squad leader. And here's a 19-year-old kid, the squad leader. Never done anything like that before in my life. And I got 6-8 guys reporting to me.
Yeah.
Now, the group gets these 3 new people coming in, replacements, because we were down and we lost 2, and we were only about 8 to begin with. Mm-hmm. And the 3 are very, you remember them. One that was a 33-year-old Boston man, wife and 3 kids at home, and later on he got killed. One, he stuck real close to me all the time. And finally, one night, we were sitting outside somewhere on guard duty outside some farmhouse, black as night, couldn't see the end of your gun. And I felt him shaking. I said, "What's the matter, Pat?" He says, "I'm scared." I said, "Well, I am too." He said, "Yeah, but I'm only 15. And so Pat went home the next day.
You ratted him out, or himself out?
No, we ratted him out. We got rid of him quick.
Wow.
And everybody cooperated in getting rid of him because 15-year-old kid don't belong out there.
Yeah, and he had obviously lied
so
about his age.
So now that's another guy out of my group. So now I'm a squad leader that's supposed to have 12 people, and we got about 7 left now.
Oof.
And so from then on, when I talked to my friends, I still talked to one guy. We had it easy. We surely did. Our job was, occasionally we were in the front line, but it was never that much exposure. The war was just about over. It's my 1st of April, the war's over the 1st of May. So let's say we had 6 weeks of combat. Yeah, we walked and rode. We ride all night in trucks and walk all day. And we were cleaning out places. We were getting rid of people out of houses. We'd kick people out of houses because we didn't want to leave anybody behind us.
Sure.
As you go through. So we really... Never were we, again, in a position where it was boom, 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 and we could see who we were shooting at. And most of us never even had to shoot anyone because we were clearing houses.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, exposed to fire. I can remember crossing a bridge one time and a mortar shell plopped in the mud right next to the bank.
Didn't go off. Wow.
It was hit the mud. Just went... But, you know, it was walk all day, ride all night, walk all day, ride all night. I've got 6 guys reporting to me, 7, 8. You mentioned, what do you do when you're in the middle of the street and you get caught? You lay down and you sweat. Or you stand and get down in a doorway somewhere. This one particular incident where I was just 2-3 days out there someplace, and one guy said, "Hey, Conan, go on, Sergeant, go over there. Wally, something's the matter with Wally." So I look around, here's Wally laying in the middle of the street, shaking like a leaf. I run up to him, he says, "If I get out of this alive, my kid's going to Sunday school every Sunday. If I get out of this alive, my kid's going to Sunday school every Sunday." So this 19-year-old philosopher that I am, you know, with all this training I've had, I say, "Here, have a cigarette." I had to get him calmed down and get him out of the middle of the street.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's just funny stories like that come back and haunt you.
And what was it, do you think, that enabled you to avoid those moments of panic where it's just so consuming that these guys couldn't function and couldn't move on?
I don't know. You survive. You look for a place to survive is what you do. Mm-hmm. And so I say you get down next to the curb. That's all that's there. You get a chance then when it's not something coming at you, quick, get into the doorway of the house next door or a hole that you see someplace next door. If you're in the country, it's down in a ditch.
You mentioned that mortar shell that lands in the mud next to you. I don't want to assume something that's not true, but it sounds like had that mud been a little harder, you wouldn't
gone
be
off.
Here.
Yeah.
And it would have killed
yeah, but,
you.
Yeah, but I realize that now, but then I'm lucky.
Yeah, no big deal.
It spurred me on. I ran a little bit faster.
How exhausting was it?
That's one of the things that... I want to talk to you later about some other thing, but that's sure. One of the things is you're dead tired all the time. And so when you go to sleep, you sleep. And if the sleep is 2 hours or 6 hours, you sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And you've never been so tired as you are. And yet you can run just as fast as you ever run. And you can get around just, and you can yell and everything else just as fast. You've got a lot of junk hanging on you. You know, you got food and canteen and all that stuff. But you can get it out of the way to run. You're invincible. You're only 19 years old.
That never wavered for you, huh?
No.
All right.
You know where you go for everywhere. You worry about your own protection. You worry about your guy's protection. You look at the ditch. You make sure you got a spot to jump to. But you don't worry it's ever going to hit you. You don't do that. I take pride in being a soldier in World War II. I do take pride. I stand straight on that. I was lucky. Very fortunate. And if I really want to get mundane about it, I say I was saved to do something. But I can, I have had a very good life. Had 4 beautiful children, wonderful wife. Went to school, got an education, ran food plants for General Foods all around the country. And so, you know, that was my want in life. I'm very proud of what I did. Yeah, from that standpoint.
I'm not trying to put words in your mouth. Is that something you think God was protecting you?
Yes, very definitely. He had something planned. He usually doesn't tell you what he's going to do.
Funny how that works. But his plans are always better than ours. You had an opportunity here a couple years ago to travel from here in California to Washington, D.C., with Central Valley Honor Flight, see the World War II Memorial and other sites. And you mentioned the people that you knew who were killed, and even that your eventual wife's brother was killed in this war. When you were in Washington, D.C., at the World War II Memorial, and you look at that big wall of gold stars, 406,000 Americans who didn't come home, didn't have the life like you've had, what did you think about? What were the things going through
your
mind?
It's a deep thought that you have. I didn't have tears in my eyes, but it was a very emotional thing for me. And I think about that, those 4,000 stars. How do you explain that to somebody, what it is? You can't do it, really. I had an opportunity to talk to some high school kids, and you get to that point, and there's no way I can express it. At least I haven't found a way to express it. You wish you could take everybody and have them stand right there and look at that thing for 5 minutes.
Underneath that wall of gold stars is the inscription, "Here we mark the price of freedom." That's Bill Koning. You can hear his complete original interview if you pull up episode number 481 at hometownheroesradio.com. It's easy to see while he'll never forget Easter Sunday, 1945, but the start of April 73 years ago was memorable for a very different reason for the man we're going to hear from next, a prisoner of war's perspective on this date in history when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, marking this Easter weekend in 2018 with the stories of three men whose experiences on the last Easter Sunday of World War II helped the rest of us to see some of the things we can so easily take for granted. In a few minutes, we're going to hear about where Glenn Schmidt did his praying on Easter Sunday, 1945, and how quickly the amazing answer to that prayer materialized. But to set it up, He was captured in a pillbox near Hattin, Germany, after obeying an order to hold at all costs and maintaining that position against all odds for more than 2 days. His helmet wouldn't fit on his head anymore because of a couple of holes a German machine gun bullet had left in it. And shortly before all that unfolded, a letter from back home in California had reached this 42nd Infantry Division soldier.
It's the only letter I can remember what in all the time that I was over there that I had received from my father. And my father was not a writer of letters, I can tell you that. He wrote a portion of the 91st Psalm, the 7th verse, where it says, "A thousand shall fall at thy side, 10,000 at thy right hand, and it shall not come nigh thee." After I read that letter and we were told to go out on this patrol, I asked the fellows to take off their helmets and bow in a moment of a prayer, which we did. I'm so thankful I did at that time because, like I say, or have told, there are some that did not survive.
And obviously that's something that stuck with you and something that really proved true. As they died all around you, you found a way to survive. We talked about your capture, and I know the journey to the prisoner of war camp is a story in itself. I want to get to the conditions inside the camp, but just getting to it was pretty harrowing. Not only are you being marched and taken on trains and transported this way or that, at one point you had a very real fear that you could be killed by your own troops who were firing at your position.
The night we were captured, we were taken to a little town by the name of Buell, B-U-H-L, and lined up in the street. And our artillery was zeroing in on this little village. The church was on fire, and they're trying to set more buildings on fire with white phosphorus shells. And at that time, in two groups, we were separated maybe 20 feet, and an artillery shell came in, landed on that street between our two groups, ricocheted through the fence, and did not explode. Now, that's a miracle in itself.
And it wouldn't have bothered the Germans a whole lot if you guys had been killed.
No, sir.
Obviously, they were leaving you out there for that possibility.
It could have been.
So, again, somebody's looking out for you. Then you get to the prisoner of war camp. And you had gone in. You described carrying around your BAR equipment, and you were strapping 145 pounds. Did you realize after you'd been captured that this starvation was going to set in? Did you realize that you would be so malnourished and fed so little?
Not at all. We had no idea. The Germans told us that the war was over for us and we could relax. But the day we walked into camp, there were approximately 100 of us, and I was up in front of the group because I had been in front of the group for some time. Without going into that part of the story, a German guard standing at the gate in good English says, "You will live from 5 to 7 months on what you get to eat here." Those weren't very encouraging words. The fellows behind us wanted to know what he said, and none of us would repeat it. But it proved to be quite true.
Well, and of course, at this point, nobody knows when the war is going to end. It's an uncertain future. You don't know what tomorrow is going to hold, but
that's true.
Is certainly unnerving. And then, as you said, it was proven true with the diet that you got. You hear about prisoner of war camps and aid parcels that show up. That didn't happen very often at Stalag 9B, did it?
No, sir. No. In the morning, they brought up, fellas went down to what we called a kitchen and brought up a barrel of ersatz coffee. It was just maybe a little chicory in it. We don't know. It had some color, and that's about it. Most of the fellas just washed in it. I drank it because I wanted something warm inside of me because there's still snow on the ground all over. We were up on a mountaintop southeast of Frankfurt, about 30 miles.
And as far as food, not much of anything. Some bread with a lot of sawdust in it, probably?
Yes. In the evening, a loaf of bread was handed to us to be divided between not less than six, mostly 10 to 12 fellas. I used my pocket knife. It was to be divided among six men or whatever. A group was chosen up, and I handed my pocket knife to him, and he cut it up as evenly as he could. The fellow who cut the bread got the last piece.
Mm-hmm.
So you know he cut it as close as he could.
And I have a surprise guest joining us on the line from Wichita, Kansas, is Dr. Bill Paschal, who, like Glenn, was a prisoner at Stalag 9B in Bad Orb, Germany, during World War II. And these two did not know each other at the time, at least not by name. But Dr. Paschal, Can you tell us quickly how you became aware of this gentleman named Glenn Schmidt and the powerful first impression that he made on you?
Yes, I sure can, Paul. Glenn is actually a lifesaver. We were in the prison camp Bad Orb, Germany, and things were pretty grim. We'd witnessed some brutality to our man of confidence. We had been lined up in the yard with the guards facing us with machine guns. The food was almost non-existent. Recreation facilities were nothing. The building that we were in was a thin board roof and upper part of the walls. When it snowed outside, it snowed inside. And actually, a lot of the men in this building that I was in, there were 3,000 Americans, but there were 300 men in the barracks I was in. A lot of the men gave up hope, and they thought that it was a question of not when they would get liberated, but how long they could survive in this environment. Some of these men turned their face to the wall and didn't communicate with the rest of us. They kind of daydreamed the day away, and sure enough, they became the first to pass away or die. One night, there was a big, strong voice came out and said, "I shall recite to you the 23rd Psalm," and this voice began to do that. There was quite a few, non-believers in the crowd. There was quite a few boos and catcalls, but this strong voice recited the 23rd Psalm and some other things from the New Testament, sang some songs, and it was almost like a miracle that barracks became very, very quiet and attentive. You could hear a pin drop. This voice kept this up night after night. And so the lights were out. 300 men crowded there. I couldn't put a face to it. During the daytime, I spent 3 or 4 days. I wandered through the crowd of people that were in our barracks, talking to different people, and I would excuse myself and go on and talk to another person. Finally, I located the owner of that voice, and that was Glenn Smith of the 42nd Infantry Division.
And he's sitting here right now, and he just heard everything you said. And he's got a little water in his eyes after hearing it. Dr. Pascoe, thank you. I know Glenn wouldn't have told us that story himself. Thank you for coming on and sharing it. Thank you for serving our country. And if you're up for it, I'd like to have you on for a full program one of these days.
Okay, that's fine. You bet.
Anything? God bless you, Bill.
You bet, Glenn.
So good to hear from you.
Yes.
I know you two share a very special bond. And,
yes, we do.
And I'll be back in touch with you, Dr. Pascoe. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Okay, you bet.
All right, that's Bill Pascoe from Wichita, Kansas, surprising Glenn Schmidt with that little story. And I know for you at home, that probably grabbed your attention the way it grabbed mine. Glenn, I think the question everyone asks is, why? What possessed you to take that kind of role and try to encourage all these other men? Why? What made that possible, and why did you do that?
Well, it was a period of desperation for us all. And I felt that if we didn't group together and try to hold the line ourselves, we would see the end like many others did. I'm just grateful to my Heavenly Father for giving me the inspiration to do that. Yeah, it's nothing in me. It's God alone.
And when the Germans took you captive, you left your helmet behind in that pillbox, but they let you take three things?
Yes, my pocket knife, my wedding ring, and my New Testament. And that New Testament went around our barracks from every day. We had Bible study, we had prayer time together, and I'm so thankful for it.
And obviously, from what we heard from Dr. Pascoe, there are a lot of other POWs who are pretty thankful for it, too. Now, you're slowly starving to death. You have no idea when liberation is going to come. When it did come, how great of a day was that for you? And did you have enough energy to even enjoy it?
At that time, I was so weak, I had to crawl across the floor, pull myself up either against the wall or against a pillar supporting the building in order to stand. And it was very difficult to walk at that time. The day before, which was Easter Sunday, 1st of April, 1945, some of us went outside. I asked the fellows if they'd like to go out for a little time of prayer, which we did. We heard machine gun fire coming up out of the valley below us, and we went back into the barracks that night, not knowing that all the guards were going to either leave or surrender the next day.
Was it almost too good to be true?
Yes, it was. It was a a day of not only liberation, but a day of elation. The motto of the ex-prisoners of war is, freedom is not free. I see that even today. There are men giving their lives for their country. We always have. Throughout, when men are called upon, men and women today, are called upon to sacrifice for their country, they seem to do it willingly. That price that they pay is the ultimate price that anyone could pay with their life. Yeah. I am deeply gratified for my God and my country.
And we're grateful for the chance to hear some of Glenn Schmidt's story. If you want to hear how he came to again become the owner of that damaged helmet he had left behind in a pillbox when he was captured, then pull up episode number 366 at hometownheroesradio.com. And when we come back, April 1st, 1945, that Easter Sunday was also the day the Battle of Okinawa began. Meet a man who may have been the first American to capture a Japanese flag that day when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.
Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. Nearly 1,000 veterans have gotten to see their memorials for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, marking Easter weekend 2018 with a trip back in time to 1945, when Easter Sunday also fell on April 1st. That was the day the bloody Battle of Okinawa began. It was the first taste of combat, and we're about to hear how literal that word taste is in this instance, for an 18-year-old sailor from Southern California named George Christman, who had been assigned to Beach Party Team 62.
Easter Sunday. We climbed out of the cargo ship, lounged the cargo nets, loaded ourselves onto them Amtraks because they weren't sure what the beach was when we get into the beach with the ship. So we went on the Amtraks. We gathered out. It was still dark. Gathered around a big circle. We had Easter sunrise service there with the chaplain. And after the chaplain had the Easter sunrise service, we left for the beach. And about that time, my commander, the beach master, had his radio, and all the big ships started shelling the beach where we were going to land to clear it further. And then as soon as we got near the beach, stopped that shelling, and the Amtrak continued on. The Army went ashore. About the third wave, we went ashore, dug our foxholes, set up the radio communications and beach markers, and started unloading ships. Very scary.
I would imagine so, and a pretty important role in that invasion. But you said the first thing you guys did was you had an Easter sunrise service. The right. Chaplain led the way with that. Do you remember anything about what was said there or what that meant to you to start that day that way?
Nope. Just scary.
Yeah. I imagine you felt like you were going to need some extra protection.
Oh, yes. Very much so.
And so you talk about the beachmaster and this landing party. So basically your guy's job was to get there first and set up some kind of organization so all these waves and waves and waves of troops coming ashore would be organized and going in the right direction.
Right.
Is that right?
The beachmaster's job is to direct that landing.
Uh-huh. It sounds like a pretty dangerous job, too, though.
Well, yes, it is.
Did you guys come under enemy fire?
Yes. We had a lot of Japanese up there in the mountains that were shooting at us.
Uh-huh. So what did you do?
Duck.
You had a foxhole and you...
Yeah, but the foxhole was only about a foot deep.
That doesn't do much good.
Because you had hard pan.
Uh-huh.
So you dug whatever you could and you lay down in there and then it rained and we got full of water and didn't worry about the water, just get down in there.
I'm trying to imagine myself in your shoes here. You're 18 years old, you're in a foxhole on the beach at Okinawa, and Japanese shells are coming in.
Well, the shells weren't coming in, it was just small fire.
Just small arms fire. But you're still feeling a little danger there.
Yes, especially at night.
And there's not a whole lot you can do to protect yourself, is there?
No.
So what goes through your mind when you're in that foxhole and you still hear these rounds going off around you?
Hope you live for the next day. And when that first day, we looked up there and it was a little house about, 50 yards or 100 yards away. They were flying the Japanese flag.
Mm-hmm.
So about three of us went up there and first we called in for an American flag to be sent in. They sent the flag in. When they got the flag, we went over took the flagpole down. It's one of those flagpoles where you pull a pin out and the whole pole comes down.
Mm-hmm.
Then we took the flag down. We put the American flag up and put the flag back. Pull back up, and that little house that was there, we didn't know it at the time, but there was a guy up on the roof was shooting at a pair of people. So eventually, after we had the American flag up, we went up there with a couple of hand grenades and blew up the whole building, and he was down on the ground, dead. No,
but you didn't
shell.
Know he was there when you were taking the flag.
No.
He could have killed you.
Oh, yeah. And then after I took the flag down, I put the flag in my pocket. You got to jumbo pockets and put it in my pocket. When I got back on the ship 4 days later, I still had this flag.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got home, I put it in my treasure chest, and my daughter was going through my stuff for 4 or 5 years. Well, it's been about 10 years now. And she found this flag. Said, "What's this flag, Dad?" And I told her. I said, "That's the one we took off a flagpole in Okinawa." And so I folded it up and put it away, and I still got the flag now.
And I imagine there were a few American servicemen, whether they were Navy like you or Army or Marines or even Army Air Corps, that ended up on Okinawa, because that was a long, drawn-out battle over a lot of territory. There are probably quite a few of them that ended up bringing a flag of some kind back. But my guess is yours might be the first one. Could anyone have grabbed the flag on Okinawa before you did?
Any one of the three that took it down. I cut it off because it was tied onto the pole.
Yes, but so there were three of you, but there was only one flag.
Right.
So you got that flag, and I'm just saying timeline-wise, because this is the first day of the battle, and you're in there early on, you were probably the first American to take a Japanese flag on Okinawa.
Right.
Yeah.
Like Iwo Jima, they had Marines, they had photographers.
Yep.
Okinawa was Army. They didn't have photographers.
So you could have been part of a Joe Rosenthal photo if Rosenthal was there to take it.
Yeah.
What, and we'll talk more about that flag and how it's come back around and led to some other developments in more recent history, but what was the significance of that for you, to cut down this Japanese flag, not just to take it for yourself, but to put up in its place the Stars and Stripes?
That's amazing. A lot of memories go by there. I look back at that flag and salute it and say, "Oh, there's my flag.
Mm-hmm.
That's our country."
And there was a long way to go in that battle.
Oh, yes. 10,000 a day would be killed.
And you'd be back on the ship for most of it.
Yeah.
But you did see some. So the first day on Okinawa, you're one of the first in. You take this flag. Still the Japanese are firing on you guys. How long did that day feel? We hear about June 6th of 44 and those guys who hit the beach at Normandy, and they call that the longest day. But how long of a day was April 1, 1945 for you?
Seemed like it never ended.
Yeah.
Especially about dusk. When it got dusk, it was about 50 Japanese planes coming over, those kamikaze pilots. Oh, they just blackened the sky. And here they come, and you just jump in and dive into your foxhole. Here come the Beachmaster down the way, and he tripped over one of the wires from the beach marker.
Uh huh.
And when he tripped over it, he fell, tipped over it. You know, he used to be a football player. So he went over, and his helmet fell off. He gathered up the helmet, put it on his head, dove into his water-filled foxhole. I can still see that big, tall guy diving in that foxhole, holding his helmet on his arm.
Uh-huh.
And these planes, terrible noise, and they couldn't get any planes off because it was just about dusk, and they didn't get any planes off, so all the ships at sea were firing.
So you have a pretty good seat for this show.
Yeah.
The ships are close enough to shore that you can see them.
Oh, yeah.
And you see the kamikazes attacking them. Is that a bit of a helpless feeling? Do you find yourself cheering?
Nothing you can do.
Yeah.
Just pray that you don't get hit.
Yeah, and pray those guys out on the ships are safe.
Because they've got some of those planes were hitting right near the beach, blowing up.
Mm-hmm. Did you lose any friends that day?
No. Luckily, we were on the beach, and the Army was moving ahead.
Uh-huh.
We had friends that got shot, but that's about it.
Uh-huh.
I got hit one time in my hand, but that's a small shell. You know, a small arm, so...
It was that day, or
reached
no?
Out, yeah. Reach down, pull it out with your teeth, because it burns. It burns like it's on fire.
Okay, you're saying that like it's not a big deal, but the rest of us, for the most part, have not been in these kind of situations. So you're 18 years old, you're on the beach on the first day of one of the biggest battles in the history of the world, and a bullet hits you?
Yep, you're scared.
So you're trying to direct troops who are still coming into shore?
Yeah, and call for whatever supplies they needed.
Uh-huh. That sounds like a pretty chaotic scene. It's probably just go, go, go.
It is go, go, go. You don't sleep for 3-4 days.
Literally.
You're up all night long calling the radio. And you might nap, but that's about it.
As troops come ashore, they keep moving inland, but you're staying there to keep things moving and coordinate what's happening. But in that job, you're on the radio, and did you know people were shooting at you, or did you just feel it out of nowhere?
You could hear them.
You could hear guns going off.
Yeah, the Japanese are... They'd had the cliff up there. It was mountains. And they had dug in big shelters up on the cliffs. And they had trails. And they'd packed the dead bodies. They'd packed in front as a guard.
Uh-huh.
So they were looking over the dead bodies. And we ended up going up there and with hand grenades and sneaking up there and throwing the hand grenade in the cave that they had built so it would be wouldn't be any more small arm fire.
But before that, you actually get hit in the hand.
Yeah. We didn't worry about that.
Well,
just a small one.
Well, what did it feel like? How did you realize what had happened?
It just burned like somebody hit you with a hot coals.
And you look down at your hand, and what do you see?
It was right here in the wrist.
Your left wrist.
You just reach in there, and nothing else to grab, and so you bite on it, spit it out, and burn your lips. And you do what you have to.
I'm sorry, I'm laughing. I'm picturing this, and again... You're talking about this so mundanely, like this is something that just happens. But you have a bullet that lodges in your wrist, a hot piece of metal.
Yeah.
And you took your teeth and bit in and got it out of there.
Yeah.
You'd never done that before.
Nope. We've been trained, though, for first-line medics because there's no doctors on there.
Uh-huh.
So if somebody gets shot or a shrapnel or whatever, you can do a minor incision and take it out. If they break a bone, you feel with it.
Uh-huh.
And you find out what's the matter, and then you tape it up. Most of those guys were, I don't care. I'm going to go on. Get me well, and I'm going. My job is to fight. Give me my rifle.
So you'd been trained to render first aid if people were injured around you. But is that how you were trained to do it, to bite a bullet out of somebody?
No, you just do what you have to.
So when it hits you, you go ahead and you clamp down on the bullet and pull it out of there and spit it out naturally. Didn't think about saving it for your kids?
Nope.
You weren't thinking about ever being married or having kids at that point.
Saving your life. Your life is more important. Get it out of there.
So what did it look like after you took the bullet out of there? I imagine there's some blood, right?
Yeah, there was blood. It was sore. You push it back together as much as you can and put a bandage over it.
Uh-huh. You had to do that all by yourself?
Yeah. Put a little sulfaformaldehyde in it and bandage it up.
Mm-hmm. Did they give you the Purple Heart?
No, because there was nobody there, no medics.
Uh-huh.
So I got in my paperwork. It was signed by the officer that I had a Purple Heart, but I can't get one because it's not in the medical records.
Really? Does that matter to you? Would you like to have the Purple Heart?
No, that's not a big price.
Well, just the fact that you got hit in the wrist, that's a pretty close call, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's pretty close to the old heart, but it's only a small arms, you know, like a .22 bullet.
Well,
so if it hits a bone, it's going to just smush her. It's not going to be like a big .30-30 rifles that the Army was using.
Well, still, if it's in the right spot.
Oh, yeah.
That could be it for you.
The neck, the head.
Yeah. So you said you were scared before that happened.
And you're scared after.
More scared?
Oh, yeah.
And you have to keep doing your job.
Well, you do your job.
And you said you guys Didn't sleep that whole 4 days you were there?
You'd nap once in a while, but the minute you go to sleep, there's something going on, blowing up someplace.
How did you do that? What do you think happened inside of you to enable you to carry out those duties, to stay awake, to keep fighting, to doing whatever you were doing?
Just the flow of adrenaline.
Yeah?
Just keeps you moving.
I'm imagining you had never experienced anything quite like that before.
Nope. No. I don't want to do it again.
Yeah. So what were those ensuing days like?
Oh, they tapered off a little bit when the Army kept further in, and the airplanes quit flying over.
Uh-huh.
So it got better, got a little easier to take.
Was it more challenging in the dark than it was during the daytime?
No, more challenging in the daytime.
Why?
You had more Amtraks coming ashore. Amtraks coming back with somebody that's been shot, and they all they want to do is get that bullet out or get that shrapnel out or whatever it is, and then go on. They don't even want to give you their name and that and their number. I'd get their name and number and turn it over to their officer so their officer could make sure that they followed up with the medics, that they didn't get any kind of infection or whatever, and got properly treated like in a hospital station. And then they put on their record that they'd gotten shot, you know.
Right. So you're helping people go in to battle in advance, but you've also got them coming back wounded. You're processing them. You got them coming and going.
Yeah.
You're a pretty busy guy.
Well, there's not that many.
Were you helping with first aid for some of them too, or
yes,
only yourself? Okay. So you had to help patch up some other guys.
We had a basic medical training.
Uh-huh.
Where we could do minor incisions and stuff like that. We had a kit there. You had to sharpen your knives and everything. It's not like the knives today are disposable.
Mm-hmm.
You had to sharpen them.
Can you give us an example of some of the things you had to do in caring for those wounded soldiers who came back?
Well, one tank driver had gotten off his tank, and he'd gone ashore kind of looking around to see where he was going to go, and he stepped on a landmine. It blew his heel. The whole heel just opened up in his shoe. That heel part just opened up, and he'd come back, and he'd got him back on the tank some way, and he came back, and he wanted to see what he could do. So he got off, and we looked at it, and it just peeled off like your sole under your shoe would peel off. And I opened it up and took the tongue depressors and scraped it out, whatever's in there, in the blood and stuff. And then I put butterfly bandages. We had to make our own because they didn't have them. We made them out of tape, put that all around it, had to cut his shoe off to start with, and then taped his foot up with an ace bandage. And I said, why don't you just lay down here and we'll get somebody to take you back to the ship. I'm from a farm up in Oregon, he said. I don't need all that kind of stuff. He says, just get me back on my tank. So he climbed back on the tank, and away he went.
Wow.
And I had his name and his number, and I gave that to his officer, and so they checked it later. Then about, almost been 40 years later, I was up in Oregon, in Yahats, Oregon, where they have a big campground-like. My wife's uncle was there, and we went walking to get the mail. And here comes some guy down the road limping, you know, kind of limping, walking away. He's older than I was. He was probably in his 80s by then. Come limping around, and he looks at me, and he's about 100 yards away. But he still sees me, and I hear this guy cussing at me. You SOB, you SOB, you're the one SOB. And my uncle says, what's this? Are we going to get involved in something? I said, I don't know who it is. And I got closer, and he says, you're the SOB that fixed my foot. Because I knew that he was up there because about 5 years before that, they called me from the Long Beach Naval Hospital. They said, I got a guy there in Yahats, Oregon, that's in the campground, and they want to do his operation on his foot and take some shrapnel out or little pebbles or whatever it is. And he says, he won't let anybody touch his foot but you. And I said, well, I'm not qualified. I'm not a doctor. I was just a frontline surgeon. He says, well, then that solves that. And the guy up in Oregon says, nobody's going to touch my foot but George. He had my name. I don't know how he had my name, but they probably told him because I had a name on what I did to his foot.
Right.
And so they called him and told him that I was qualified. And so when I saw him up there, he's cussing me, you're the SOB. And so I had to go up and meet his wife, and she was crying. You saved my husband's foot. He said, if it hadn't been for you, he'd have lost his foot. Mm-hmm. I said, well, we do what we have to. That's not easy.
And that was 40 years after the war, is that what you said? Or maybe longer?
Yeah, at least 40 years after the war.
In all that time, had you ever wondered what happened to him?
Yeah, but then when they called me from the hospital, I knew he was okay.
Until then, you didn't know if he lived or not, probably.
No.
Yeah, because there were a lot of guys that died on Okinawa. How fulfilling was that for you to see him again and understand how much it meant
good.
To him?
It touched my eyes.
I believe it. It's bringing a little water to your eyes right now.
Yep.
Yeah, and probably a few people out there listening. So that's an example. Really, you're kind of a jack of all trades there on this beach in Okinawa.
Well, I've been lucky.
Uh-huh.
The good Lord blessed me with abilities to do a lot of things.
Well, I guess so, and I know Chevron appreciated that for 50 years. You were the guy that could fix anything, even if it was a compressor 10 times the size of the room we're in right now. But, again, you're on the beach in Okinawa for just a few days.
About 4 days.
But real intense days.
Oh, every day was intense.
When you look back, is it hard to believe that you did what you did?
Yeah, hard to believe in my lifetime what I've done.
Sure.
The good Lord blessed me with the abilities to do a lot of things.
I guess so.
I've taught school. I come out of the Navy as a certified diver. I dove for Chevron in many of the countries.
And I want to talk about the diving stuff. But before we wrap up Okinawa, was there anything else that you witnessed or experienced in those 4 days that really stands out to you now?
Just how terrible war is, how much threatening they were to coming to our country, our United States of America.
You also mentioned the Japanese gun that hit you. It left you that little bullet in your wrist that you had to bite out of there. That you guys negated that threat when you threw a hand grenade into the cave that they were shooting from. Did you go with that party to toss that grenade in?
Yeah, we'd sneak up to walk and pull a pin and throw it in that cave.
That's a little nerve-wracking too, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Makes the chills come to your skin.
Yeah. It's a pretty dangerous duty.
You throw that hand grenade over dead bodies, it's covering the hole. It's scary.
I would say so.
I wouldn't want to do it now. I'm too old.
You mentioned that gentleman whose foot you fixed and the incredible story of reuniting with him all those years later. So you saw guys coming back in that kind of condition. Did you also see dead bodies coming back?
Yeah. They brought them back, stacked them up until they get enough to take them out to sea and dump them.
How hard was that to witness as an 18-year-old?
Terrible.
Is there anything that prepares you for that?
Nope.
How did you deal with it? How did you keep going?
Well, I actually worked for the lifeguards in the summertime. Uh-huh. And you go out and rescue these people that are in riptides and drowning and stuff like that.
Here in Southern California, you did that?
Off Hermosa Beach.
Uh-huh. So coming through in a life-or-death situation was nothing new for you?
No. You do what you can. Do what you have to.
Uh-huh.
What you're trained or what you aren't trained, what comes naturally, I guess you could say. God's blessings, you know, you do what you can.
Let's talk about this flag. You still have this flag today. I'll put a photo of it at hometownheroesradio.com and the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll put a little video there of Mr. Christmas showing us the flag. There's a pretty neat story with that flag. You showed it to a young lady a few years ago?
I had a neighbor that about 12 years old, the girl.
Uh-huh.
And her father says, do you remember anything about World War II? And I said, yeah, a little bit. She said, well, she's going to write a thing of history class about World War II. So I went through her and showed her and did everything with the landing at Okinawa. And when the war ended, stuff like that, and she wrote it up. And she had a picture of her with this Japanese flag. She got first in a group there in Los Angeles. And she went to San Francisco and got first in the state for her essay. And they thought that was so great that they sent her back to Washington. And she got first in there. And they gave her, I think it's 5 or 6 years scholarship for her essay.
All because of you and your flag?
Yep. All because of her writing.
Before I forget, I want to say thank you for serving our country. And thank you for telling us about it. Is there anything that you think those of us who were not alive in World War II need to know about you and all those other millions of Americans who were fighting for our freedom and, in reality, saving the world?
We just did what the people are doing now. They're saving our country, keeping us safe and keeping us free. And we thank them all for all the service they're doing.
Amen.
We have many in the service now that's keeping our country free. Thank God.
Amen. What are you most proud of?
Greatest country in the world.
Mm-hmm.
Being an American. Can't beat that. Be proud of that. Don't try to tear the country down. Try to build it up. Let's all get along. Try to treat one another like we'd like to be treated.
Advice that sounds simple sometimes becomes difficult, but is always worth it.
from a man who lived it. That's George Chrisman. Like the other two World War II veterans you heard from today, you can find his complete original interview at hometownheroesradio.com. And I don't know about you, but as I enjoy the company of family and friends this Easter, I'm not going to take that privilege for granted. 73 years ago, on April 1st, 1945, it was a bullet-riddled boat on the Rhine River, a barren prisoner of war camp in Germany, or the bloody beaches of Okinawa. And we know so many of our American servicemen and women are in harm's way on this holiday weekend. Why don't you say an extra prayer for them today, and also one of gratitude for all of those who have put their lives on the line for us over all these years. That's our program for today. I'm Paul Leffler, hoping you'll remember on this holiday and every day that freedom is not free.